everyone, and welcome to this discussion of the wisdom writings in the Bible. So thus far, we've been looking at the different parts of the Old Testament. We've been looking at the Torah, the former prophets, the historical writings, the prophets, and now we're getting into some different types of writings that we find kind of in the middle of the Old Testament, known as the wisdom writings. And the wisdom writings are made up of three different books. The first book is the book of Proverbs. And so when we think about wisdom, we think about these little nuggets of kind of practical truth. And this is what Proverbs provides. And it gives a particular theological worldview. And the emphasis here is that there's really no division between the sacred and the secular. So for those of us who live in the West, we're used to kind of the separation of church and state. You've got the cultural stuff that you do and then church stuff and so on. And what Proverbs is trying to argue is that all of life has been ordered by the Creator. What we find in Proverbs is what we would call a creation theology, that if we look at the creation, we can see the divine order, the blessing, and the way in which God sustains all things. The book of Proverbs assumes that the world is knowable and that as a people of faith, a people who believe in God, we can see how the creation itself reflects who God is, and that what we find in the created world is a divine ordering. When you read Proverbs, wisdom is the knowledge of God, so the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and sin is likened to foolishness. And the way that Proverbs works is through this sense of blessing and curse. So if you obey God, if you follow God's law, if you follow Torah, if you live a life of faith, there will be blessing. If you live a life of disobedience, and if you live a life of sin and foolishness, your life is going to reflect this. So in the New Testament, you know, when Jesus tells the parable of the wise man who built his house upon the rock and the foolish man who built his house upon the sand, it's kind of like you get what you deserve type of thing. And Proverbs kind of speaks to this idea that when we look at the created world, we see the divine order, and by following Torah, by listening to God, by walking in the ways of God, we will receive blessing. And to engage in a life of sin and evil, that is what is considered to be foolishness. Now, what's interesting is right in the middle of the book of Proverbs, in chapter 8, we get this chapter that focuses on kind of the personification of wisdom. It says, "Does not wisdom call, and does not understanding raise her voice? For wisdom is better than jewels, and all that you may desire cannot compare with her." And then it goes on to say, "I, wisdom, live with prudence, and I attain knowledge and discretion. The fear of the Lord is hatred of evil, pride and arrogance, and the way of evil and perverted speech I hate. I have good advice and sound wisdom. I have insight, I have strength. By me kings reign, and rulers decree what is just. By me, rulers rule, and nobles, all who govern rightly. I love those who love me, and those who seek me diligently find me. Riches and honor are with me, enduring wealth and prosperity. My fruit is better than gold, even fine gold, and my yield than choice silver. I walk in the way of righteousness, along the paths of justice, endowed with wealth, those who love me, and filling their treasures." And then in verse 22, it goes on to say, "The Lord created me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of long ago. Ages ago, I was set up at the first, from the beginning of the earth. When there was no depths, I was brought forth. When there was no springs abounding with water. Before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth. When he had not yet made earth and fields or the world's first bits of soil. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle in the face of the deep. When he made firm the skies above, when he established the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limit, so the waters might not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him like a master worker. I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world and delighting in the human race. And now, my children, listen to me. Happy are those who keep my ways. Hear instruction and be wise and do not neglect it. Happy is the one who listens to me, watching daily at my gates. waiting beside my door. Whoever finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord, but those who miss me injure themselves. All who hate me love death." So in that passage, we see this fascinating personification of wisdom. And we can see how for the Jewish people, the Torah or wisdom was there from the beginning. It's the divine word by which God created all things and ordered all things. So you see the connection between Proverbs 8 and the creation story, how God speaks through the divine word and brings order from chaos and structures the cosmos. And you also see in there this emphasis upon listening to wisdom and taking wisdom seriously and the blessing that comes from taking wisdom seriously. And then if you don't listen to wisdom, you end up in death and foolishness and evil. And this is exactly what the book of Proverbs is doing. It is trying to kind of cast this worldview in which all of the creation of cosmos is rightly ordered by God's wisdom. But then we get to the book of Ecclesiastes. And in Ecclesiastes, we're kind of getting a little bit of a counter to the book of Proverbs. If you know anything about the book of Ecclesiastes, you'll know that one of the main lines in there is meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. Now, the way the book is structured is you kind of have an editor. And so chapter one and the very end, you get this sense that someone else is kind of bringing together these sayings that are attributed to this teacher. Now, oftentimes the book is attributed to Solomon, but at any rate, it is attributed to this teacher who comes to kind of recognize the meaninglessness of chasing after things like wealth and power, and that the things of this earth and the ways of this earth kind of come to naught. You get a sense that the person who is speaking in the book of Ecclesiastes is somebody who is been through a lot of things, and they're bored with life, and they've come to kind of see the futility of life, the struggle of life. So rather than seeing this sense of divine ordering that we find in Proverbs, the book of Ecclesiastes opens up by saying, "Vanities of vanities," or "meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher. "All is meaningless," or vanity. "What do people gain from the toil at which they toil under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hurries to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south." In other words, he's describing all of these things that just seem to be kind of going on and on and on and on. Chapter 3 says this, "For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under the heaven, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh." And so it's as if the teacher is looking at life and having been involved in life, it's as if they've reached this kind of hardened sense of old age, and they look at the world and they see that things just kind of keep going. And what's lost here is this sense of the divine ordering, the divine blessing, and instead you're kind of gripped by this person who seems to have been drained of joy and kind of looking at the ways of the world and how things just kind of repeat themselves and how things keep going. So in some sense, it is a counter to the book of Proverbs. And this is the interesting thing about what the Bible does and what the different books of the Bible tend to do. So Proverbs comes and says, hey, all of creation is ordered and, you know, wisdom and blessing and so on. And Ecclesiastes is saying, wait, not so fast. It just seems like things keep going on. You know, this sense that God sends rain to the just and the unjust. It's just a part of this world that kind of keeps going. Now, what you get at the very end, though, is kind of this call to obey the law. So this is where you kind of see that there's an editor at work here. "The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for that is the whole duty of everyone. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil." And so, it ends with this kind of call to obey Torah, to obey the law. And so whereas Proverbs is saying obeying the law is to live into the ordering of life that God has given, granted in blessing, it's almost as if Ecclesiastes is saying, look, life is rough and things just kind of go on. Meaningless, you know, vanity of vanities, and yet obey law, obey Torah. And then we come to one of the more fascinating books in the Bible, which is the book of Job. And Job also functions as a counter reply to the book of Proverbs. So if you think about it, Proverbs is saying that the creation is divinely ordered in a certain way. If you obey God's law, you'll be blessed. Well, the book of Job opens up with this kind of vignette where the accuser, Satan, and the name Satan is actually a title that is given to one who's an accuser, comes before God and says, look, Job is only worshiping you and doing this because you've blessed him. Strike him down and he'll curse you and he'll no longer follow you. And so this is what happens. The Satan or the accuser is allowed to take these things from Job, and he enters into an immense amount of suffering. And a couple of things happen. He curses his life. His wife is telling him, curse God and be done with it. But he doesn't. And so the whole book is this kind of wrestling. And what's important for us to recognize about the book of Job is Job is wanting God to give an account of himself. It's almost as if, and there's a part in the middle of the book of Job where he says, for I know that, you know, my Redeemer liveth. The Redeemer is the kinsman Redeemer. It's like a lawyer. He wants to lawyer up and he wants someone to give an account. He wants somebody to plead his case on behalf of God. And what he's really looking for is for God to come and give an explanation. And throughout the book, Job has these friends, and these friends are trying to explain to him why they think that he's fallen into suffering. And they give kind of the traditional Christian answers, like, you're not obeying, you know, if you think of Proverbs, right? Foolishness, you know, sin leads to foolishness, which leads to curse. Obviously, you've done something. You've wronged God. I mean, who do you think you are? And so interestingly, Job gives all of these kinds of answers. But when you get to the end, all of a sudden, God shows up. And he says to Job, like, all right, you want me to respond. Here is the response that I will give you. And what happens is in chapter 38, the Lord gives his answer. And what's fascinating about his answer is he never addresses any of Job's complaints. God goes on to describe the creation of the cosmos. He goes on to describe these weird mythological creatures, behemoth and leviathan and all of these. And he says things like, you know, can you catch leviathan with a fish hook? Can you tame the great behemoth? And he goes on and on and on. And he gets to the end. And Job basically says, look, I speak without knowing. I'm sorry. But what's interesting is he hasn't had any of his issues addressed. God then goes on to want to punish not Job, but Job's friends. And I think this is very important. The people at the end of the book who are in trouble, it's not Job asking for God to give an account. It's Job's friends who are representing God wrongly. And I think it's important for those of us who are Christians who take, you know, the Bible seriously to read Job carefully and recognize that Job is vindicated and Job kind of mediates on behalf of his friends. And again, Job functions as a form of counter reply to the book of Proverbs. And so it's as if Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Job are all wrestling with each other about the human experience, about suffering. And when we get to the Gospels and when we get to Jesus on the cross, it's important to, I think, put the suffering of Christ and his cry from the cross in the context of Job. So Jesus is in the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? He's quoting Psalm 22. It's a Job-like cry. Give an account. What's going on? I don't deserve this. Why is this happening to me? And so we see that kind of resonance with the book of Job. So those are the three books that are really called the wisdom writings. And we can see how they engage one another and how they interact with one another. Now, there's some other books that we need to talk about that we find kind of in this part of the Bible. And one of them is called the Song of Solomon. And the Song of Solomon is again, a very, very interesting book. It's very erotic. It's love poetry. It is a book that describes, at face value, it describes two lovers. And it uses all kinds of metaphors from the natural world to describe how these two lovers are kind of entangled with one another, and they love one another, and their desire is for one another. But the reason this book is in the Bible, I think, first of all, it is an affirmation of human love and even sexuality and things like that. And I don't want to take away from that. But what's fascinating is that the Song of Solomon is often read in Jewish circles around the time of Passover. So when we think about what Passover is celebrating, it is speaking about a God who comes to his people to deliver them from oppression. And really, chapter 2 of the Song of Solomon is read during this time. The voice of my beloved, look, he comes leaping upon the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look where he stands behind our wall, gazing in at the windows, looking through the lattice. My beloved speaks and says to me, arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. And what's significant about this is it's as if the Song of Songs is describing the Exodus event, the God who comes through Moses, the God who comes bounding over the mountains, comes to his people who are stuck in Egypt and in slavery and says, let's go. Winter is over, spring is here. And that's how the rest of that chapter goes on. The flowers are blooming. Love is in the air. You know, so we can tell spring has come. And it is the God who comes to take us away and to take us into a pasture, like a shepherd who is leading his sheep into, green pastures, like the psalmist says. And so when we read that text, we read about God's love for God's people. And again, you know, for the longest time, the Song of Songs was, and Song of Solomon was interpreted allegorically, which is kind of a figurative interpretation. And many Christians today read it that way, as, you know, Christ's love for his church and so on and so forth. And that's kind of fallen out of favor. And so now, you know, there's a sense of wanting to get at what, you know, what is this text really about? These two lovers, so on and so forth. And yet all of the study that I've done and looking at some of the Jewish rabbis and stuff who have commented on this text and use it in the reading during Passover, recognize that it is metaphor for God's love for us. And I think there's a way to talk about how in Jesus Christ we see God's love revealed for us. And so this is what the Song of Songs or Song of Solomon is doing. And then we move into some of the other writings, and we're going to talk about very, very briefly, but, you know, one of the things I try to tell people is, you know, if they come to me and they say, hey, I need a devotional, or, you know, struggling with my devotional life or whatever, one of the easiest things to do is to read the Psalms. What you get in the Psalms is Israel's response to God. You get this poetry, you get these hymns that where Israel is expressing their response, and you get the whole kind of array of human emotion. You get these psalms of joy, these psalms of worship. They talk about royal psalms. You get these psalms that rehearse the history of Israel, kind of a memory of what God has done for us. You get psalms of lament. You get psalms that express anger. You get psalms that talk about bashing the infants, our enemies' infants' heads against the rocks. And what are we supposed to do with these things? Well, these are the emotions that Israel feels as Israel engages with God, goes into exile, and is trying to think about their identity is now that they're in exile. And so it's important to place the Psalms also in the development of the synagogue. So when Israel goes off into exile, we talk about that in the prophetic writings. Israel goes into exile. they no longer have the temple. And so what develops is the synagogue, where they gather together around the Torah, around the scriptures. It's very word-based, but they also talk about bringing a sacrifice of praise, that, and their prayers become sacrifices. So they light candles and incense as a way to show that their prayers are now going to God as a form of sacrifice. And the way that the synagogue develops is the Psalms get read antiphonally, where there's a call and a response that moves back and forth between these Psalms. And the Psalms become the heart of kind of Jewish worship in the synagogue. Some of the other writings too, kind of the post-exilic writings, when we get to Ezra and Nehemiah at one time were one scroll. They were one, you know, these books were written in scrolls, and now we have them in our Bible, and they're separated out into their own books and so on. But Ezra and Nehemiah used to be one writing, and it's about the post-exilic return. And so the Israelites are coming back from exile. Ezra is leading a contingent of people back to the Holy Land, back to the Promised Land, and he is a priest. And so he looks at the people, and he's trying to get them back into following God's law. And one of the interesting things about it is you get this purity issue in Ezra. So some of the people have intermingled and they've intermarried. And so as they recover the law and begin to read and renew covenant with God, one of the things that happens in Ezra is they send away some of these wives. So again, there's a sense of purifying themselves kind of post-exile. It's about covenant renewal. It's about renewing the covenant with God so they can live in the land again. It's about coming back to rebuild the temple wall. This is what Nehemiah is about. And it's about kind of the conflict that exists with the people who are there. So as they come back, there are people who had been left behind, and there are other people who have been kind of shipped into this part of the land from Assyria. And now the Israelites find themselves in conflict with these people. And so some of that kind of is going to set the stage as we think about the developments in the New Testament and the different struggles that they're having as they live in the land in the New Testament. The book of 1st and 2nd Chronicles, again, 1st and 2nd Chronicles is originally kind of one scroll. And what it is kind of a post-exilic interpretation, so post-exile interpretation of the history of Israel, of God's people. So what's interesting about it is you're going to find some of the same stories in 1st and 2nd Chronicles you would find in 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings. One of the differences is they've been cleaned up a little bit. So if you read 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings, David, you know, he's a man after God's own heart, but he does some things he shouldn't with Bathsheba and some other things. Chronicles is trying to clean some of that up. It also starts kind of with these genealogies and going all the way back to Adam and kind of reinterpreting or retelling this broad history of the people of Israel all the way from Adam to this return as they're coming back. And again, what you're getting to is an interpretation of the monarchy. And so it's a different voice, and it's a kind of a different perspective on the monarchy and some of the things that have happened in some of the other writings like 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings. You also get this book of Esther, which is set in Persia, the King Xerxes, and it's about how Esther, a Jewish woman, comes to save the Jewish people. You get a conflict between Haman and Mordecai. Haman wants, he despises Mordecai, who's a Jew, and he wants the Jewish people just done away with. And so he kind of tricks Xerxes into signing a decree that the Jewish people are going to be killed on this certain day. And Esther then ends up within the harem of Xerxes and is favored. And Esther, through kind of works it, she uses that place of privilege to find out what Haman is doing, and they're able to counteract it. And she saves the Jewish people. And then you get the book of Daniel. And Daniel is a fascinating book. It's made up of two different parts. The first part is what we would maybe look at as kind of narrative or history. Daniel and his friends in exile in Babylon, You get the story of Daniel in the lion's den. You get the stories of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But then the second half of the book is this apocalyptic form of writing. We only have one other form of apocalyptic writing in the Bible, and that's the book of Revelation. And so Daniel receives these visions. And these visions are dealing with empires, they're dealing with rulers, they're dealing with the oppression of God's people, but also the hope that one day a people would rise up and free the people from bondage. In the same way that God freed the people of Israel in Egypt, God is going to free the people in once again. He's going to act once again. Now, most likely the text is dealing with a Greek period of Antiochus Epiphanes and kind of this Hellenism where they come in and they try to force the Jews to no longer be Jewish but live like Greeks. And we read about that in the book of 1 Maccabees, which is part of the Apocrypha. And so even though Daniel is set in kind of this Babylonian and Persian empire, we see King Nebuchadnezzar and these other kings. It really has kind of in its sights the experience of Israel as they were living in under the Greeks, and that those visions that we get of the apocalyptic writings. One final important point that I want to make here as we kind of push ahead now into the New Testament is to kind of take stock. What is the hope of the Old Testament? So after kind of going through all of these different things, reading about covenant and Abraham and David and Moses and the Exodus, but then getting into exile and the prophetic writings and things like that, what is at the end of the Old Testament? Where do things land? And then what is the hope of the people? One of the things that I want you to see is how at the heart of the Old Testament is the problem of exile. So if we go all the way back to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, what is the problem? Well, sin and disobedience has led to exile. It has led to being sent out of the presence of God. When we get to the prophetic writings, what do we find? We find this sense that God's presence has left, the Spirit has left the temple, and they're sent away into exile. They're waiting for God to come back. They're waiting for the people of Israel to be reestablished, for God to come and establish a king. So I want to emphasize a few things here as we talk about what is it that the people are waiting for, and how does this then connect to the gospel? When we think about the word gospel meaning good news, like what is the good news? What is the gospel of Jesus Christ? We have to understand it in the context of the hope of the Old Testament. So number one, the hope is that God would come and restore his people, that God would come and deal with the Gentiles, that God would come and restore Israel. Overthrow the nations and establish his king like David. They're waiting for God's Spirit to come and dwell with his people. They're waiting for God's presence to return. And they're waiting for God to come and bring an end to the age of sin and death and exile, and usher in the new age of the new heavens and the new earth, which is grounded in Sabbath, in shalom, in God resting, in creation being at rest. This is what they are waiting for. And we're not going to be able to understand the full depth of what the Gospels are trying to get at unless we put that good news in the context of this Old Testament hope.